This is Jeff Blankford. My guest today, Garth Porter, who you've heard many times in Takes on the World, is an independent investigative journalist and historian who's been writing on U.S. national security, issues since the Vietnam War. His articles can be found at Consortium News, The American Conservative, and Truth Out, among other publications. In 2012, he was the recipient of the Martha Gellhorn Prize for Journalism, and he is the author of Manufactured Crisis, the untold story of the Iran nuclear scare, by which I interviewed him earlier. Today, he is one of a handful of journalists who have been facing down the anti-Russian hysteria that has been dominating the national daily discourse without let-up, and Takes on the World is here to give voice to that dissent. Welcome once again, Garth Porter, to Takes on the World.
Thanks so much for having me again, Jeff.
I'm glad to have you back. I think I've had you on my programs much or more than I think any other guest. I want to speak to you about your latest article on Consortium News exposing the fake news about the Russians' alleged hacking the voter databases of 21 states. But first, I want to get your take on the brouhaha surrounding Donald Trump Jr.'s emails and the meeting he set up with a Russian lawyer, which was attended by first son-in-law Jared Kushner and then Trump campaign manager Paul Manafort. Is this as serious as it is being presented by members of Congress and the media?
Well, I think the answer to that is very clearly no, it's not as serious as it's being presented. I mean, this is really the latest installment in this ongoing drama, this political drama that has been created, which suggests that the Russians are capable of subverting the U.S. government, hacking into our electoral databases, and threatening the results of our elections, and threatening even our power grid across the United States. That we are virtually helpless before the onslaught of the Russian government, which is on the verge of, I'm slightly exaggerating now, is on the verge of taking over the United States. This is just an absurd situation created by a media complex that has really gone off the rails in a way that I have never seen in my lifetime.
Every day there seems to be a new revelation that makes this seem like the most enormous problem. You know, I mentioned in my introduction is that we didn't have any kind of investigation about a far more serious problem, the Iraq War, in which showed all kinds of manipulation within the U.S. government by the neocons and so on. No interest in that. And as a matter of fact, it's interesting that, and I'm going to ask you about the visit by Trump to meet with Putin, in which they actually did negotiate a ceasefire in Syria, which apparently may be holding, because it didn't rate a single word in the New York Times today.
Right.
Astonishing focus mysteriously mistaken focus by the media as well as our politicians, particularly the Democrats and self-styled liberals who are leading this campaign, apparently trying to do anything, including risking war, to take Trump out of the White House.
Well, I mean, I don't know if I would go so far as to say that they're risking war to get Trump out of the White House. I would say, however, that the intelligence community has clearly been become committed to this new Cold War with Russia to a degree that is unprecedented in the, to my knowledge, in the history of the Cold War and since. And therefore they are committed to a particular way of dealing with anything that has to do with Russia now, and particularly, of course, with regard to Trump, because that's the big enchilada politically in this country, and everybody knows it. And so there is a record now of the FBI, the CIA, and DHS in particular, those three NSA has to be thrown in the mix as well. Basically, deliberately skewing the presentation of intelligence that relate to Russia and domestic U.S. society in a way that is alarmist, to say the least. And I think that is, again, a very, to my mind, it's a very alarming situation.
Well, it's ironic that you have to go to Fox News, for example, to hear Professor Cohen speak about Russia, whereas I turned on the night of Trump's meeting with Putin, I saw NBC online. I don't have a television because I can't stand it. And I watched Rachel Maddow just go off. I couldn't believe this. And then she went to this veteran correspondent, Richard Engel, who had a prepared segment prepared for this particular day to show in which he interviewed the Russian chess champion Garry Kasparov, who claimed, speaking in Moscow, where he presumed to be in danger, that Putin was the greatest threat to humanity on the planet.
Yeah, I know. That is the cast of mind that's being expressed through all the various strands of corporate media these days.
And you also could comment the fact that they keep repeating as if it's a given, a fact that 17 intelligence agencies have concluded, and it's like a no-brainer that the Russians meddled in our elections and did the hacking. And yet Clapper himself has said it was only three agencies, and this was confirmed by Brennan, and yet nobody questions this. Where does it end?
That, by the way, is an important point, because the difference between the three agencies and the 17 agencies is that when you talk about 17 agencies, that suggests connotes a process which is very formal and has very fixed rules about how to produce an intelligence product, whereas what we're really talking about is an informal process among the top-level officials of those three agencies. That is exactly what has happened. And so there's a huge difference in terms of the significance of what was produced between the three and the 17. And I want to make sure your listeners are aware that Scott Ritter has just published an important piece in the American Conservative today on this very issue. And, of course, he's very familiar with these questions of how the intelligence community works. And so it's very much worth your audience's taking a look at this article.
Tell us again who Scott Ritter was. He, back in the Iraq War, he was a weapons inspector, no?
That's right. But he is, of course, somebody who interacted with various parts of the intelligence community and knows very well how it works. That's the point.
And this is an article in the American Conservative, which you also write for. It's a source of much more interesting articles on what's going on in the world than one finds perhaps in the Nation.
Absolutely. There's no question about it. And I have just really published my first article in the American Conservative recently, last month. But I do, in fact, intend to publish more with them. I think that is going to be one of the outlets that I'm going to be relying on in the future.
It seems that the election of Donald Trump has turned the world upside down, much of the world upside down. That was when you find people who are supposedly anti-war and love peace and international cooperation are the ones who are leading the charge against Putin, against Russia, and also by inflammation against regime change in Syria and against Iran, it's kind of a crazy world out there. It's kind of a rearrangement of an order that had been existing for at least a half a century.
Well, you're absolutely right about that, Jeff. And in fact, the implications for an independent investigative journalist like myself are quite significant, because it means that some of the traditional, I shouldn't say traditional, but some of the outlets that I have relied on in the past are no longer available. I mean, you know, it seems clear that there is a not just a drift, but a stampede towards a new Cold War mentality on the part of Democracy Now, The Nation, and other traditional left-wing outlets.
It's difficult. So many people are so used to trusting these outlets, and yet what you get essentially is what I would call a neocon line, who as to who is a good guy, who are the good guys, who are the bad guys, and that even The Intercept, which was seemed to be a promising news source, as you mentioned in your current last article, even went and bought a whole cloth fabrication about the situation. Perhaps you talk about that.
Well, that's right, and that is indeed one of the additional indications of this, what I call a stampede toward a line which is much more a traditional Cold War, and as you suggest, a neocon-like, maybe neocon-light view of the current international situation.
Now, it's interesting. We're hearing talk now about Russian collusion or Trump administration's members' collusion, including with Russia. But even had this has happened, this seems to be a very different situation than the question of hacking. It seems like it's like a bait and switch in which obviously the Trump operation had business interest in Russia. He had the Miss Universe pageant there, and Eric Trump, his other son, once bragged about the amount of business investments they had in Russia, which would be understandable given that Russia is not a socialist or communist country, but a capitalist country, and has business dealings with businessmen all over the world, and yet they're trying to conflate the two as if there's a connection between the hacking of the or the release of the Democratic National Committee emails and Podesta's emails and the meeting with Michael Flynn or Jared Trump or Jared Kushner or Donald Trump with Russian individuals, this lawyer or other Russians.
Exactly right. And indeed, I would suggest that conflation is really what the entire corpus of corporate media coverage of the Trump-Russia issue has been all about. I mean, they have continued to conflate the, you know, quite different phenomena of contacts with Russian intelligence officials or Russian officials who are involved in the kind of questions that would touch on the U.S. election, for example, and ordinary Russian businessmen or Russians who are not directly connected with the government. That's one of the kinds of conflation that's gone on. And the other conflation, as you suggest, is between the question of contacts with Russians over business questions and contacts over the election. Now, the other problem that I would point to, and obviously you know, this is implied in what you said already, but it seems to me it's worth making quite explicit. You know, we're now being told that it is illicit and perhaps even illegal for someone to talk to a Russian lawyer who has contacts with the Russian government to get information of a damaging nature on your electoral opponent, whereas the DNC went to somebody to collect information from officials of the Russian government, which was damaging to Trump. That was an official part of the DNC electoral strategy, to have a dossier, what they call the dirty dossier now, what it's called, the dirty dossier, on Trump, which was collected in large part in Russia from people connected with the Russian government. So I'm sorry to say that personally, I don't see that this is a distinction that makes a difference.
And they bragged about it. That they had high-level official in the Russian government. They bragged about it.
It was treated as intelligence that was passed out by the former director of national intelligence, Clapper, to a wide variety of officials in the Obama administration. So, I mean, that was one of the things that I flagged earlier on as an abuse by the intelligence community in general and by Clapper in particular.
Well, why I initially called you to interview you today was because of the widespread belief among Americans and perpetrated by the liberal media that the Russians are so powerful that they have hacked into the voting databases of at least 21 states. And also before that, they interrupted the Vermont electrical grid, I think it's all did something in Illinois. They are all powerful, but yet there's something lacking in the story. I think it might be truth. Tell us about it.
Yes, exactly. I mean, to my mind, you know, this whole story of hacking into the databases of states for voter registration is a classic example of news media skewing a story to such an extreme that it is worthy of Pravda or Trud, if you will, in the Stalinist era of the Soviet Union. You know, the reality is, as I point out in my story, that these electoral databases at the state level have been under cyber attack continuously for years, that there's nothing new about cyber attacks on these websites that hold the electoral databases, the voter registration databases. And I got this directly from the legal advisor to the Secretary of State of Illinois, who I interviewed for this piece, who told me that, yes, our databases, the state voter registration databases, have been under attack ever since 2006, continuously. It's never stopped. There are just thousands and thousands of attempted hacks on the website that has these databases. And he said, it's not just the voter databases. Every database that our state has in its confines. And that's true for other states as well. So, the Secretary of State of Arizona also didn't talk to me, but talked to another journalist. As I recall, it was Mother Jones. It was a story from Mother Jones. And explained that the FBI had told her personally, or had told not her personally, but her the person who worked on cyber affairs, cybersecurity for her, that the FBI was aware of the hacker who was responsible for trying to get into the Arizona database. And that it was a hacker who they had followed in the past. It was a well-known hacker. And furthermore, the person who worked on cybersecurity for the Arizona Secretary of State told her that the FBI said that they found that the hacker had gotten hold of the username and password for someone who had access to the database, and that it was found for sale on the dark web. Now, I don't know if your listeners know what the dark web is, but it is the part of the cyber universe that you have to have a special a password in order to get access to, and it's used by the criminal hackers to sell their wares. In other words, this was a matter that involved trying to get hold of personal information for sale on the internet. And that's exactly what happened in the case of the Illinois case. They know that this was a matter of criminal hackers trying to get access to personal information, and indeed they did get access to personal information on the Illinois site for sale on the internet because it has commercial value. It had nothing to do with the Russians.
It's interesting. In your article, the title of the article, the listeners, is called Foisting Blame for Cyber Hacking on Russia, and you could find that by going to the Consortium News site, written on July 2nd. It's interesting, we hear the former prosecutor, now a member of Congress, Adam Schiff, all the time on NPR, either being interviewed or reported, one of his comments being reported on the news. And you have Schiff going for a teaser, as you put, by James Comey about Russians hacking the data, voter databases, and Schiff saying there was no doubt Russia's behind the hacks on state electoral databases. And this is somebody who is considered the go-to person for the media on the Democratic side in the House. Maybe you come
right, and this fits into the whole narrative that I'm really describing here in this interview, in that as soon as Comey, delivered this hint, it was no more than a hint because he knew perfectly well that they did not have hard evidence that the Russian government was behind any hacking of an electoral database. But he deliberately left the impression that they had reason to believe that the Russians were involved in this. But as soon as that happened, then Schiff jumped on it and simply stated that this is the fact. And from then on, Schiff and other Democrats treated this as a fact. And so that's the way the system has been working, to create an illusion that there is no doubt, as he put it, that the Russians have hacked into our electoral databases. And this is taking us into really, as far as I'm concerned, new territory. I mean, this is, in a way, there have been comparisons between this political sort of meme, if you will, about the Russian Trump-Russia collusion and the hacking into the election, and McCarthyism, the McCarthyite accusations. But in many ways, it's much worse because McCarthy was, although he did have a lot of popular support, there was resistance to McCarthy on the part of members of political parties and even the Eisenhower administration. So, I mean, this is a situation where it's free fall in terms of that idea that the Russians were behind all this hacking and that they've achieved a degree of collusion on the part of the Trump administration. This has been essentially accepted as the truth without meaningful political resistance in this society. So, in fact, we're in a much worse situation. In my mind, this is really unprecedented. And maybe I'm wrong. Maybe one could point to situations historically where there was something of equally sensational that was where there was no resistance whatsoever. But that's at least the way I view it at this moment.
My guest is Gareth Porter, investigative journalist, and we're talking about, if you could guess, the campaign to tar Russia with every crime on the planet, and with making Trump our president, hacking state databases. What is interesting is that the word alleged has disappeared from the vocabulary of the media. They used to. When this young man killed 9 black worshipers in South Carolina, everybody knew he did it. He was reported as the alleged killer.
That's right, yes. I agree. This is a very
And alleged, it has simply been dropped. It isn't that the Russians allege meddling. The Russians' meddling is taken as a fact, and it's even repeated. And then you have someone like Charles Blow, the liberal columnist for the African-American columnist for the New York Times, writing about how Trump had his, Putin had his thumb all over the U.S. elections. I mean, this is the kind of journalism. I actually, you know, grew up during the Cold War. We didn't have social media or all the media outlets that we have today. We didn't have the internet, but I do not remember anything as intense on a day-to-day basis about things that are really not world consequential in terms of war or peace. And here we have the Syrian war, and if they have negotiated a ceasefire, which seems to have lasted longer than others, and they don't even make a mention of it in the media, it's not fit to print in the New York Times. What it says, and I maintain that one thing, I think Trump is a grotesque character, and we had the worst choices ever in the last election. But when he calls the mainstream media the enemy of the people, whatever his reasons, I would argue the mainstream media arguably has been the enemy of the people. It's been lied to the people all of my adult life about the wars we got into and did not allow any kind of dissent until things were going wrong with the war. And so here again today, across the board, and particularly with the party that's supposed to be for peace and war, against war, the Democrats are leading the charge. It's extraordinary.
Well, I first of all, I appreciate the point that you're making about the historical analogy here, or the historical comparison, I should say, with the Cold War period, and I think that that is very well worth taking seriously, because it does, you know, what you're doing is confirming my feeling that this is in fact unprecedented in the history, in U.S. political and societal history, that we have such a one-sided presentation of a political issue that is extremely far-reaching, goes to the very core of a democratic system in this country, and virtually, you know, is just completely dominating the political scene. So, you know, it does, I think, demand that anyone who has an independent view of this situation, is not already completely taken in by this, really think very hard about what we can do to push back. Of course, I agree with you that Trump is a terrible choice for president. I mean, he's grotesque in many ways. But I also agree that the media is indeed the enemy, and far more so than ever before. And this is an extremely acute issue for anyone who cares about American democracy.
It doesn't seem to be getting any better. It's caused major divisions within, let's say, I can't call it the anti-war movement, because there isn't an anti-war movement. We haven't had an anti-war movement since before the launching of the Iraq War. I find it really distressing, bewildering, and depressing that Obama, who I believe was put in office to mesmerize any opposition to the war, when he effectively pardoned the criminals by saying we're going to look forward, not backward, there was no response, criticism of the public. Who generally elected Obama because he had supposedly taken positions against the war, although not very strong ones, if one looks at it too closely.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Yes.
I think the point you're making is correct. The only additional point that I would make is that is simply to distinguish between anti-war movement as an organized effort. Which does in fact respond to a leadership that says, okay, now is the time for us to protest, now is the time to take action, and a situation in this country where it's very clear that there is even greater disaffection, a greater popular disaffection with regard to the what I call the permanent war state, the complex of military and intelligence agencies, and of course their private contractor allies, who have such enormous political power in this country, and their continuous and nonstop wars in the Middle East and beyond the Middle East. I think over the past 10 years, this disaffection has been growing steadily. And by 2013, when Obama was prepared to carry out unilateral military action in Syria over his so-called red line, there was an enormous backlash, which Congress felt, and it was registered there that they were not going to be ready to support this. So, you know, and there are other forms of evidence for this, which I think is extremely important to understand. And again, it challenges people who are opposed to this permanent war state to come up with ideas for how to reconstitute an anti-war movement. It's very important to do that at this point.
I'm glad you made that point, because actually the protests that in the members of Congress in their districts against expanding the war to Syria was such that members of Congress decided and told Obama not to do it.
Indeed.
That needs to be exploited and expanded upon. One thing that was really troubling is that the other section of the Democratic Party, headed by Bernie Sanders, held a public summit in June, the middle of June, and they had 12 items on the agenda. Not one touched upon U.S. foreign policy and the stopping of our enduring wars in the Middle East. Nothing at all. It was all domestic issues. And the only Sanders made in his speech was to jump on the anti-Russian bandwagon.
That's a very bad sign, and I agree. It's very disheartening, because I thought that, you know, I admit that I had some hope, I had considerable hope, that the Sanders movement would translate into some degree of organized resistance to the permanent war state, and that has proved not to be the case thus far, at least. I mean, again, I think that many of the I can't say most at this moment, I, you know, with any confidence, but I think many, certainly, of the supporters of Sanders really do oppose the permanent war state, but they do not have the leadership of that organization clearly do not hold that view. It's not important to them. That's clear.
Well, it seems that it would not be an accident that the U.S. foreign policy and our wars in the Middle East and the expansion of the U.S. military footprint across Africa, which occurred under Obama without any kind of comment or public protest or much information in the mainstream media about it, it seems that there's some kind of a deal maybe going on. We'll have to see about that. Garth, I'm really glad to have had you on our program again today to shed some light. Rare light on a sea of darkness that we are getting from our media, and that's why we're here, and that's why folks like you who are writing and contributing these articles are really important to keep the truth out there. So thanks so much for being our guest today on Takes of the World. Look forward to talking with you again.
Thanks so much, Jeff. I appreciate it.
This has been Jeff Blankfort. Thanks for listening.